Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of March 19th, 2019. House lawmakers just approved the $9 billion budget, but what's that mean for you? In a year with an additional $1 billion to spend, where did lawmakers put that money? And you could possibly even see a $50 tax rebate thanks to the Mega Millions winner. Also, we had the latest on the Carolina Panthers and how they could soon one day call Rock Hill home for their headquarters and practice facilities. And we got a live taping alert for y'all. We're going to be in Florence on March 28th at Seminar Brewing in Florence at 6:30 p.m. So come out, have a pint with us, and enjoy some great discussion. We'll have the Post and Courier's Jamie Lovegrove and the Associated Press's Meg Kennard. We're going to be talking 2020 in the Magic City. Also, we'll have some trivia, swag, and giveaways. Russ will be there with some great trivia. And again, we're going to be in Florence at Seminar Brewing, March 28th at 6:30 p.m. You can find a link for that on seetv.org/sclead. The Lead is a podcast where we go behind the headlines with the reporters who write the stories affecting you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. You can listen to all four sections while you get your new keys made and get a new ATM card after your eventful St. Patrick's Day. Or while you look forward to the Worm Supermoon on the first day of spring, which is March 20th. Yes, Worm. Now for our brief Worm quorum call. Worm call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present, but here in the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Number one, the state newspaper reports that over the course of 2 years, the South Carolina Department of Corrections released 10 inmates well before the end of their sentences because of an error made when calculating the length. Of the 10 inmates, 4 have yet to be recaptured. The Department of Corrections is still working with the courts to take steps to reincarcerate them. Number two, the state newspaper reports that a Senate panel has weakened dam safety laws for many of the state's 2,400 regulated dams, even though scores of them break every year during storms and flooding. For years, South Carolina had one of the nation's weakest dam safety programs, but after the October 2015 flood, legislators pumped more money into the Department of Health and Environmental Control, increasing staffing to inspect and oversee dams. But the legislature never tightened the state's law that critics say don't have enough teeth. Even so, the South Carolina Farm Bureau wants the law loosened, arguing that rural landowners are being unduly burdened by state regulation. Number three, the Post and Courier reports that President Donald Trump included $138 million in his budget to deepen the Charleston Harbor to 52 feet so it can handle heavier container ships. This is the first time money for the project has been included in a presidential budget. Should this request get funded, it would put the $558 million project closer to full funding. The state previously set aside $300 million for it and also a $50 million loan. Dredging began last year on the project, which will be complete come 2021. And number four, we got some March Madness news. AT, let me get some Lead sports music. Friday will be the first time since 1970 that Columbia will be hosting an NCAA tournament game, according to the state newspaper. Ole Miss will face Oklahoma at 12:40 p.m. at Colonial Life Arena. Duke will play at 7:10 p.m. against the winner of Tuesday's North Carolina Central versus North Dakota State game. And following that game on Friday will be VCU facing off against UCF. And two games will follow on Sunday at Colonial Life Arena, with the winners advancing to the Sweet 16 round. And for some homework for y'all, check out the Post and Courier's Above the Law investigation on South Carolina sheriffs. We'll be talking about that in a future episode. And just like everyone calling out sick this Monday for food poisoning, I see you, I know you, we buried the lead. House lawmakers last week spent long hours debating the $9 billion budget, amending it, and finally sending it over to the Senate on Wednesday. Now, passing the annual budget is always the most important legislative task for lawmakers, and this year there was a little bit of something for everyone with an additional $1 billion to spend, half of which was one-time dollars. Education was a key theme for the budget, which included about $159 million for teacher pay raises, money to freeze tuition, $112 million to address overdue maintenance needs at colleges, and more. There's also money that will go toward giving taxpayers a $50 rebate, thanks to the Mega Millions winner. However, this is not all set in stone, as now the Senate Finance Committee will begin crafting its version of the budget, and we'll see more of that later. Now, additional big news last week included the announcement that the state is working to relocate the Carolina Panthers headquarters and practice facility to the Rock Hill area from Charlotte. Lawmakers are going to be working to change the laws that would allow them to give tax incentives to the Panthers, similar to other corporations that locate in the state. So there's a lot to talk about. That's why we have Mayon Schechter with the state newspaper and Jeffrey Collins with the Associated Press. Welcome, y'all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's been great to see you guys. I know, Mayon, you've been a repeat offender, I guess, guest, we should say, not an offender. Just good to have you back.
Yeah, thank you.
You seem very well rested after your long week.
I feel like a new woman.
There you go. Yeah, you're covering the budget and the Panthers news, so a lot going on there.
Yeah.
And Jeffrey, we haven't caught up with you since the beginning of the legislature, and now at the start of the legislature, and now we're like more than halfway through here. So we're just churning along right now.
I'm glad to be here. I was worried some trash talk about Maryland had you holding it against me for a while.
But it's nice to be back. So Jeffrey, let's talk with you. We were in a budget briefing the other week, and Representative Gary Simrell, who's also the House Majority Leader, was talking about how they haven't really worked so closely with a governor on a budget like they have with Governor McMaster on this year's budget. And, you know, looking at the governor's budget, which was kind of, it's always more of guidelines when he rolls out his budget, and then also what we saw pass the House, there are a lot of similarities. There do seem like they aligned, at least, you know, with goals, sometimes monetary alignments in the budget. But for the most part, they seem like pretty similar. Is that some sort of indication of just how well everyone is working together in the State House these days?
Yeah, I mean, it's obvious from the budget debate that the governor and the Republicans in the House worked very closely together to craft that budget. I mean, there are some differences. I think there's about $20 million less in that rural school closing fund in the House budget than Governor McMaster wanted. You know, there's a lot of things that are similar. I mean, you know, the everybody wins Mega Millions $50 rebate is basically what McMaster had planned just before. We just rebranded it as, you know, everybody gets a little chunk of this lottery winning, you know, so that there was that. And most of McMaster's priorities are in this budget. It's very interesting. And we had everybody's been getting along pretty good so far.
Mm-hmm. And Mayon, are you seeing similarities too, like what Jeffrey's saying in terms of budget goals and then also just funding amounts? I mean, yeah, the Rural Infrastructure Fund, I think it was about $85 million versus the $100 million he asked for. Mm-hmm. And that's to help kind of give incentives to build out certain resources, certain projects, improvements in like about 28 school districts in the state that are kind of poor and have a hard time getting things done. Is that going to be pretty key to education funding this year?
I think so. But I think the money that the House set aside for pay raises for teachers is going to be the big ticket item when it comes to public education funding this year. But I agree with Jeffrey. It seems that everybody is in agreement. Everybody seems to be getting along very well. There wasn't a huge fight on the House floor last week over dollars. There were fights over many other things. But over the exact amount for priorities, there really wasn't a huge fight. Obviously, you, Gavin, and you, Jeffrey, have covered the legislature for more years than I have. I only have last year to talk about. But compared with last year, you know, this year, the House put money toward state worker employee raises. They put money toward teacher salary raises. And if you look last year, there was no money put in for state workers. There was a very small amount put in for teachers. So I think there's been an effort to not only get the entire Republican caucus on board in the House, but also to reach out to Democrats to get them on board.
And those teacher pay raises, I mean, McMaster asked for 5%, the minimum of 4% for some teachers, goes up for others. Are teachers happy with those that range of pay raises, Mayon? And can you explain what we're seeing with those?
It depends on who you ask.
Yeah. Depends if you're a teacher for a short amount of time versus a long amount of time.
Right. I think overall, teachers are happy to see that the starting salary is going up to $35,000 from $32,000. And that's not to say that every teacher that starts out was making $32,000. Those are generally in those districts that could not afford to pay more. What we're hearing from some teachers that have been teachers for a long time is that they're not necessarily happy that teachers with 0 to about 5 years of experience will probably get a larger chunk of this money than they will. But lawmakers, House budget writers in particular, were very clear that 0 to 5 range, those are the teachers that are leaving. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're having a hard time recruiting teachers in the first place, but that 0 to 5 range, those are teachers that are leaving within that time period. So when you ask House budget writers why put more money toward their raises, it's so that they can retain them longer than that 5-year period.
And Jeffrey, this is substantial investment for not only teachers, but also education in this budget. When we look at that rural investment fund for improvements in schools and for teacher pay raises, is this going to help maybe fix some of the problems we've seen plaguing education in South Carolina for the past few years?
It does say something that this much money that they were able to get together and agree to spend it this quickly. I mean, that rarely happens in South Carolina. It usually takes years and years of a crisis to develop before we get to the point where we're putting big money into it to solve. But, you know, is it going to solve everything in education? Oh, man, that's probably... No, I don't think the whole package doesn't get passed this year. I mean, they're going to have to take a small bite out of it. I mean, you know, yeah, while the House is getting along, the education bill got through and everything, it's not the kumbaya moment in the Senate yet. I mean, you know, on all sorts of things. I mean, I think about Glenn McConnell, and when he was president pro tem of the Senate, one of his favorite things to say was, you know, after the House would pass a budget or a bill was, oh, now we get to deal with the inartfully crafted House budget. So, you know, that's the way the Senate feels about it. And that's the way they feel about it this year. So there's going to be, while we had this budget that's gone basically unchanged to a great extent, I don't think it gets all the way to the finish line like that, because, you know what, there's 46 senators, so there's 47 different plans. So, I mean, we'll see what happens.
Yeah. And some of the additional money for school was also, what, $2.2 million for about 90 additional mental health counselors, money for more school buses, and hiring some SROs. So, I mean, there's a little bit of something for everyone in this budget then, Mayan, essentially, to say, hey, let's not tinker with it too much because we're all getting a little bit of something that we need here.
Yeah, I think so. And, I mean, again, it's every person's perspective is going to be a little bit different, but it seems that House budget writers, the House overall, has really tried to make a concerted effort to throw money at those areas that they haven't funded in a while and haven't been taken care of.
And so when we look at other aspects of this budget debate, another big issue was the Planned Parenthood part of it. It was a 13-hour debate you guys were covering, essentially, in the House there.
And I think maybe it took out 2-3 hours, if I remember correctly. Last week was like a little bit of a blur for me.
But so what was the whole aspect? What was the whole point of that, the Planned Parenthood debate, essentially trying to not send any money to Planned Parenthood, even though they don't fund abortions in the state?
So unlike last year, because last year, if you remember, in the House, it dealt with those family planning dollars out of Medicaid. Right now, that case, if I remember correctly, is sitting in the court system still. It's been appealed. A judge issued a restraining order on it. And so we actually didn't predict that abortion would come up. When I had spoken to conservative House members, they had told me, particularly one had told me, that he didn't see a point in bringing it up because of this case, that it's been stalled in the courts. Obviously, that was wrong, and I should have known better. So there was an effort this year to attach a proviso, which lawmakers were successful in doing it, but attach a proviso to the budget that would ensure that no state dollars go toward Planned Parenthood to pay for abortions. It also further sought to block federal dollars from paying for abortions as well. However, according to Planned Parenthood, and from anyone in the health sector that I've talked to, no state dollars go toward paying for abortions, with the exception of the mother's life is at risk, incest, rape. And what we found out last year was, I think in 2017, there were only 5 abortions that were covered under the Hyde Amendment, and all of them were done at hospitals. So when we heard this proviso coming down, there was a lot of confusion over what does it exactly do. And there are even some Republicans who said, clearly, this was a lot about politics. This is kind of a pattern that we have every year on the budget floor. This was what to be expected.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it was the first time abortion has been brought up in the South Carolina General Assembly
so far
this session. And, you know, if you look at states around us, you know, Georgia's in the process of debating a heartbeat abortion bill. Tennessee's pushing one through. All these states across the Southeast. And South Carolina, for, you know, 20, 30 years, we've kind of been at the vanguard of General Assemblies that put more restrictions on abortion. So there are a lot of conservative lawmakers in the South Carolina House and in the South Carolina Senate who have been frustrated that with the new climate in the federal court system and everything, well, why isn't South Carolina doing more about abortion? But the thing in South Carolina that's been kind of interesting from the 2018 elections is it's just a shade less conservative than it was in the Senate. The John Corson seat flipped over to Dick Harpootlian, who's so from a Republican to a Democrat. The one open seat in the Senate is William Timmons' Greenville seat, which is extremely conservative. So the Senate is actually a tad bit less conservative than it was last year. They had that fight last year that Brad Hutto pulled the little thing where, you know, he amended the bill so it gave the conservatives exactly what they wanted. You know, it took a, banned almost all abortions, and they couldn't push that. There was some squeamish Republicans that couldn't feel like they could vote for that, you know, in good conscience. So, I mean, that's been the interesting thing about abortion is it hadn't been discussed that much. I have conservative lawmakers that tell me that, yes, there are the nine or more abortion bills that are out there right now are actually going to get hearings and things as we get towards the end of the session. And there's not a whole lot of things floating out there except for education. So I could see that happening. But I'm not sure whether it gets anywhere this year.
Because there's not the momentum that's needed in order to actually make it make an easy debate, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, things can change. I mean, certainly, like I said, there's some conservatives that were being very, they would tell you they were being very nice and considerate, and they didn't want to push this issue. But I think it will get pushed eventually, because if you're a conservative lawmaker, this is the most interesting climate and the most supportive climate you've had for passing more laws to restrict abortions, both in the court system and politically in, you know, forever.
Right.
So go for it.
And I was going to say, with 2020 looming in the distance, it's good for them to talk about it.
Everybody's up for re-election in 2020.
And I was already told that, you know, Richard Cash, who's the senator from Anderson, could possibly be facing a primary challenger, just because his only one issue is obviously he's very big on abortion issues. But I think a lot of people want him to do more than just that. And I think that's what's going to be drawing some fire for him in the primary going forward. That's what someone close to Republican leadership told me about just going forward. So I think, you know, maybe it is obviously a big issue in other states, but at the same time, it can also maybe hurt you if you're not working on other issues in South Carolina.
Well, there's always that tug of war in conservative Republican districts, especially more in the Senate than the House, because they're a little bit bigger and a little more, you know, House districts are a little smaller. But there's always that push and pull against, well, are you just concentrating on social issues? Because, you know, I care about my taxes and I care about this. So there's always that push and pull. And, you know, I talked to Senator Cash last week, and I was struck a little bit about, he wanted to point out to me that, no, I'm just not a one note person. I'm just not about abortion. Yes, I want to get this passed, but, you know, there's some other things out there I want to do. And that was a little bit different than some discussions I've had with him in past, you know, months and years.
So moving a little bit more broadly. So just also want to talk about the state pay raises. There's also money in there for judicial pay raises, which we haven't really seen move in a while. Money for public defenders going up, direct care staffers at Department of Disabilities and Special Needs, and correctional officers. So it sounds like budget writers are really looking forward to not even just, you know, retaining teachers when we look at pay raises, but retaining these state workers, especially in such a good economy when you probably could be tempted to jump somewhere else and get some more money, Mayan.
Well, that's when I remember, you know, last year on the floor, there was a lot of talk about we need to put money towards the agencies that are having the hardest time hiring and retaining. But it seems to be more of an overall for most agencies, there's a huge issue with hiring and retaining. And so I think we're seeing that obviously concerted effort to make sure that you hear a lot about this from particular state worker advocates who say stop pitting state workers in particular against other agencies. Mm-hmm. So it appears that there isn't an effort this year to ensure that there is not any of that pitting. I mean, of course, some workers are going to get higher, you know, pay raises than others, but overall it seems that everybody could potentially be happier than last year.
Mm-hmm. And that, again, goes back to a lot of people just, you got to keep them on staff. And then there's some movements to actually bring back retirees to bring them on staff as well. They can come back after a year period, not get dinged with the pension as such.
And that'll be interesting to see whether that sticks in the budget in the Senate. If my memory serves me correctly, I don't think the Senate moved forward on that last year. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember if it was an issue of cost or just like how many people was it actually going to bring back. But anyway, it'll be interesting to see if that sticks in the budget. I thought that was probably the most interesting proviso that got attached to the budget last week.
Mm-hmm. But we did see other provisos, other amendments get knocked down to Democratic amendments. And there was talk about how Republicans were told not to vote for Democratic amendments. And then that one kind of got shifted around, saying that wasn't entirely the truth.
Yeah, that was Representative Jonathan Hill, who kind of stirred the pot on the House floor. Mm-hmm. Not rare for him, but I don't think that Republicans were particularly happy about that.
Mm-hmm. Dealing with class sizes and how to spend that additional money from Mega Millions. But Jeffrey, so now we go forward to the Senate. The Senate's going to work on this in committee, then eventually debate it in mid-April. Then hopefully everything kind of wrapped up, between both houses in May. Any surprises we should be looking forward to, or anything that we should, you know, be aware of going forward with the Senate and how they work in crafting this budget?
Of course, it's the Senate. There'll always be a surprise. I mean, there are several senators right now working on surprises, probably as we speak.
Yeah.
But you know, the Senate's just a different place, and it's you know, the fact the state has roughly $1 billion of extra money to spend is going to have the wheels turning in a lot of people's minds as they want to, you know, maybe shift a little bit out of here to there or whatever they want to do. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm also struck, you know, last week the Senate spent a day on a filibuster by Marlon Kempson over spadefish.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the end of, you know, they went back and forth for 2 hours and it was going nowhere. And when Senator Gerald Malloy stood up to ask the Senate to adjourn, he said, you know, I move we adjourn because I think we have a lot better things. You know, we need better things to talk about. You know, we don't have anything to do right now.
Yeah.
And there's not a lot other than education in the future. And they're still crafting that. So without a lot of stuff to do, they may just do all sorts of things with the budget. I mean, it could be a very interesting couple of weeks over on the other side of the state house.
Yeah, and then the spadefish debate, obviously, Kempson's way of trying to get a hearing on his Charleston loophole bill that's kind of stuck in subcommittee, which Senator Kempson's over. Senator Kempson's spadefish bill, it's all the joys of watching the Senate be the deliberative body that it is.
The Senate, you know, you have, and this that was the thing with Kempson and Kempson is fairly new, but man, in the Senate, you've got stuff that goes back two or three decades. I mean, you'll see somebody stand up and you'll sit there and try to figure it out, and you'll think in your mind, like, oh yeah, in 1997, there was that filibuster over that, and that's why he is mad at him, and you know, so it's always an interesting
thing. To be fair, and it was interesting, I know we got to get onto the Panthers, but when you mentioned how, you know, Senator Joe Malloy got up and said, don't have better things to talk about. Well, you know, they did have that whole debate the prior week, looking at, you know, the death penalty and having to make the electric chair part of you know, the default way of executing inmates on death row because we don't have the drugs to do lethal injection. He said, why are we doing this? We're rushing this through. And then it's funny how things change next week where we're wasting time all of a sudden. So, but catching up, we want to talk about Senate and House leadership who joined the governor last week to talk about this big announcement about the Panthers. Carolina Panthers might be relocating their headquarters and training facility to the Rock Hill area. Mayan, you guys were really on top of that story. Just kind of give us the rundown. And obviously, you guys did a big update story on it too this past weekend, where things stand at this point.
So we know that Wednesday, McMaster and House and Senate leadership, as well as other lawmakers, held a private meeting with Panthers owner David Tepper, his team, his legal team, to talk about this potential move to South Carolina, moving the Panthers' headquarters, their main operations, and building training facilities in South Carolina. That meeting maybe lasted about an hour, 45 minutes to an hour, and then they left, and leadership joined McMaster outside of his office in the State House to announce that they indeed are trying to lure the Panthers to South Carolina. I think we're gonna hear this a lot, is one team, two states. So based on our reporting, the Panthers are eyeing the York County area, more particularly the Rock Hill area. I know that the governor mentioned Lancaster County during that press conference, but then a Lancaster Senator Greg Gregory came out on Twitter, and he was at that private meeting with David Tepper and said, nope, they're not looking at my county, they're looking at York County. So it's
because
pretty
of the connectivity, the closeness, the interstate. I mean, there's a lot in the land that's gonna be looked at up there.
Right.
The airport you mentioned.
And things are moving pretty fast. As we've talked about, this week, the House and Senate, their respective finance committees are gonna take up this core job tax credit, job development credit bill that would include professional sports teams that would help them get incentives in the state.
And Jeffrey, this is, you were there too. I mean, this is some pretty exciting stuff. And to see them move like this and to be out in the open like this, I mean, Andy Shane did write a story for the Post and Courier back in December mentioning that this could be a possibility. Now it seems like they're going full force ahead. What do we take from this, and when do you think we'll officially know? Do you think we'll know once we have everything wrapped up into a nice little package of incentives and infrastructure? Or, you know, what's the next step at this point?
I mean, it's happening fairly quickly. You know, I find it a little interesting that we have not heard from David Tepper yet. And so I don't know if he's still trying to work something in the background or what. I mean, obviously, we know he wants a new practice facility. Mm-hmm. You know, the Panthers had to practice inside a hotel ballroom late in the season last season because we had all that rain and they have an outdoor facility. So he wants to move very quickly on this. I mean, I obviously can't get it finished before this upcoming season, but I certainly would think before the 2020 season, he wants everything in place. So the time frame is very narrow here. Mm-hmm. Obviously, don't know what Charlotte or North Carolina is trying to push back on. And then if you look even further in the future, you know, this is, I think the Panthers' first season was in the mid-90s. So we're about 25 years into this. They've had Bank of America Stadium for up for almost 25 years up in Charlotte, in Uptown Charlotte. So there's going to be some push for either a new stadium or a massive upgrade on that fairly soon. And so where does this practice facility fit into it? I mean, you know, no one's talking about it because it's in the future. You think the practice facility is an interesting debate. Well, you know, it's a magnitude of 10 bigger if they want to build a stadium somewhere. And if you have your practice facility in Rock Hill, what's the next logical step? I mean, you know, yes, maybe you're two states, one team, so you keep your stadium in North Carolina. But if you're South Carolina, suddenly you're like, don't you just want to be able to live in South Carolina, drive 5 minutes to your practice facility and your stadium and everything together? Now, like I said, that's way off in the distance, but, you know, you can see that cloud looming on the horizon. And mm-hmm. And that will be a huge fight between North Carolina and South Carolina if that ever comes to pass.
Right. And we reported that Tepper is looking for up to 200 acres. So certainly that allows room for growth. But our sources have told us that the stadium has never come up in conversations, and that another source even told us that Tepper really likes having a stadium in Uptown Charlotte. He understands the importance and the value of keeping it there. But like you said, I mean, that certainly could come up to play years from now once this project is in its 20th year.
Mm-hmm. So two states, one team. A lot more needs to be determined, but we are moving ahead pretty quickly, so we'll stay tuned with everyone's reporting on that. Thanks to Mayan Schechter with the State Newspaper and Jeffrey Collins with the Associated Press for joining me this week.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Gavin.
It's that time again for some campaign trail news updates. We're looking at the latest in 2020 related movements affecting South Carolina, state campaign news, and highlights from the state's congressional delegation. Leading us off, Senator Lindsey Graham announced that he will kick off his 2020 re-election campaign on Saturday with some help from Vice President Mike Pence. There will be a kickoff brunch at 11 a.m. in Myrtle Beach and a reception in Greenville at 3 p.m. You can get tickets for $20 on lindseygraham.com. The Associated Press reports that Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris added two experienced operatives to her South Carolina team. The California Senator's presidential campaign announced Wednesday that Reggie Abraham has come on as deputy state director. Abraham is an Orangeburg native and worked for Hillary Clinton's unsuccessful 2016 presidential campaign, and was also a political coordinator for Stacey Abrams' unsuccessful 2018 Georgia gubernatorial campaign. Ann Bailey is Harris's state organizing director. She's an Anderson native and a former national field director for NARAL, Pro-Choice America, and served as marketing director for the grassroots advocacy firm Winning Connections. And this week, there will be a slew of 2020 Democratic candidates and potential candidates coming through the state, according to the Post and Courier. On Tuesday, Terry McAuliffe, the former Virginia governor, and Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton will be in Columbia. Beto O'Rourke, who just announced his candidacy, will visit the state on Friday and Saturday. South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg will visit Greenville, Columbia, and Rock Hill on Saturday. And New Jersey Senator Cory Booker will return to the state and be in Rock Hill on Saturday. You can catch out some sound bites from these guys on the campaign trail by checking out Trail Bite episodes for quick, insightful takes on the 2020 Democratic presidential candidates who come through the state, and also some reaction from South Carolinians about the candidates and the race. If you subscribe to the South Carolina Lead, you'll automatically get this mini pod on your phone or wherever you get your podcasts when they drop on Thursday. This week's episode will feature Senator Bernie Sanders, who was in the state last week. In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure that lawmakers use when speaking to each other. Did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is back with some great state trivia? Well, here he is, Russ McKinney in studio.
Hey.
What you got for me, Russ?
Well, we've been talking about the budget and next year's budget in the General Assembly. And of course, you know, those budgets spend money and they spend revenue that comes into the state. And of course, the state gets its revenue by taxes. Mm-hmm. always causes a lot of interesting debate as they go through the budget. But the question this week is, did you know what the first state of South Carolina tax was.
Huh.
And we're talking about way back, actually, in the colonial period, to be honest with you, what the first state tax levied by the first South Carolina state government, or the early state government. Ready? Okay.
So yeah.
We get through these. A would be a road tax, B, property tax, C, income tax, D, sales and use tax, for lack of a better term, on the sales tax.
Yeah, nice and generic. I like this. No cigarette tax there yet, huh?
Not yet.
We're waiting for those. Sales and use just sounds nice. I mean, I know that's kind of like the broad category. Road tax, I mean, my gosh. What were you paying for your dirt roads back then, literally?
Maybe you had to pay to use the roads.
Yeah, that's something, sure.
Permission to use the roads.
Their carriage, I don't know. I think I'm just going to go with, I'm going to go with property tax. I don't want to elaborate too much on that, but I might just go with property tax.
And that is correct.
Holy cow. Two in a row, folks.
Property tax was the very first tax that the state levied, and it's been a matter that has vexed state officials ever since then as to how property tax works, what should be taxed, assessments, et cetera. The very first property tax simply taxed your property regardless of what it was used for. Of course, that didn't last too long, and then ever since then, it's been an up and down and round on what should be taxed and not taxed. Of course, today, property tax pretty much is at the local, at the county level. But at that time, it was a huge state issue. Mm. Not only did it involve large tracts of land that were producing lots of revenue for farmers, say, but at one point, slaves were considered property. So it's been a contentious issue for many, many years.
All right, keep on paying those property taxes. I paid my property tax on my vehicle. I look forward to doing it every year. It's one of my favorite things to do. Get my tax refund. Pay my tax bill with it. And then I make sure I go to the library because I see how much I'm paying to go to the library for. So anyway, that's not here nor there. Thank you, Russ, for some great state trivia.
Some easy stuff.
Pay your taxes. The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on scetv.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio, and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and southcarolinapublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at @SCLeadPod, and you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course, our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle at @SCLEDEPOD. We have swag, sticker swag that is. Send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your name and address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on March 18, 2019. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Secret message. Fill in your own secret message. What do I look like?
I had food poisoning. I can't do the secret message.